Today at Reader's Corner, in honor of Veterans Day, we talk to C.J. Chivers, author of The Fighters, Americans in Combat in Afghanistan and Iraq. I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have spanned three administrations, costing billions of dollars, thousands of lives, and untold casualties. Additionally, more than 2.7 million Americans have served in Afghanistan or Iraq since September 11, 2001. But many of these personal stories remain untold. In this encore edition of Reader's Corner, we talk to journalist C.J. Chivers about his book, The Fighters, Americans in Combat in Afghanistan and Iraq. In the book, Chivers embeds with soldiers on the front lines to describe the personal, physical, and emotional toll of the war on terror, wars in which more questions than answers remain. C.J. Chivers is a correspondent for The New York Times and a writer at large for The New York Times Magazine. He's won the Pulitzer Prize for his writing and reporting from Afghanistan and Pakistan. Chivers served as an infantry officer in the United States Marine Corps in the Persian Gulf War. He is also the author of The Gun, about the history of the modern assault rifle. C.J. Chivers, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you for having me.
One of the things that really caught my attention in the opening of the book was your explaining how you chose to bypass the officials in the Pentagon, the brass in the field, elected officials in Washington, and go right to the U.S. servicemen on the field. Could you help us understand what you were after there?
So there's two reasons for that. One is that I'm a former Marine myself, and was a former Marine of not much rank, and a member of the infantry. And so my competencies and my interests reside at the bottom of the hierarchy, you know, down where the people who actually experience and fight and suffer and live through these wars actually work and operate and hopefully come home and reintegrate. But the other reason is I work for a large, complicated newspaper, and we're able here to diversify our coverage among the reporters. So there are a lot of different ways to cover a war, but no one reporter can do them all, or certainly can't do them all at an equal level of skill. And so I have focused on the bottom. And when I did this across many, many years, while we had other reporters who were dealing with the policies, who were dealing with the politicians, the generals, the strategies, the larger brushstrokes of the war, we had an ample number of people to cover that, which freed me up to go right out into the field and be with the people who are actually living through these policies.
You know, one of the things I'm always careful to do, CJ, is to make sure I get pronunciations correct. And I wanted to make absolutely sure I was pronouncing your last name correctly. So I went online to check out YouTube and find some interview. And boy, that came up with a really interesting one in 2013. Colbert had you on. And trying to field Colbert's questions is always tricky. You did a great job in that interview, but you talked about being embedded with the rebels in Syria at that time. The conversation was about Syria, not about Iraq and Afghanistan. And you talked about how you went in from the Turkish side and you were, in fact, embedded with the rebels. When it comes to this book on Afghanistan and Iraq, how did you go about doing this? Because as I understand it, you did spend time in the field with some of the six men you choose to focus on in your book.
You know, most of the characters I knew from being on the ground with them or in the air with them in Afghanistan or Iraq. And that was sort of a natural consequence of my job across time. I mean, the New York Times was using me to go out into the field and do long-term embeds with different military units at different places and phases and times in these campaigns. And I did that across many years. And I came to know hundreds and hundreds of people. And when I reached the point there that I wanted to write a book, I went back through, you know, this sort of large social network that I knew of people who remained in the military, people who were out of the military, people who had been wounded or not. And I tried to find a set of characters who I thought would be representative of many of the stories that I knew were common or familiar or idiosyncratic of these wars. So you can kind of imagine that I knew a very large population of people and that the book in some ways became like Noah's Ark or something. You know, I had to select a few out of the many to come on this journey with me.
Yeah, and that had to be a tough call, without question. You know, before I even got into your first chapter, and I think I remember standing at the bookstand trying to decide, now, do I want to read this, and would this be a good interview for Reader's Corner? And I opened it up, and there's this quote that's a handwritten note on the wall of the government center in Ramadi, Iraq, in January of 2007. And it just kind of blew me away, and I thought, I think this is what this book is about. America is not at war. The Marine Corps is at war. America is at the mall. Could you comment on that?
So that was a photograph taken by a friend of mine, John Moore, works for Getty Images. And he made that image, as you said, in early 2007. You'll remember 2007 was a terrible time in the war in Iraq. That was when the insurgency was out of control, and the moment when we had decided roughly that there would be a surge or an uptick in American forces, that they were going to commit more combat troops to the war to try to tamp this down. But many of those troops had not yet arrived. So this was a period of intense, pitched, difficult fighting. And for some on the ground, I'd have to say deep frustration, even in some cases hopelessness that things could be turned around. And this statement, we have to sort of look at culturally and socially. And there's a reason that the Marines felt that isolated, that they felt separate, that they were fighting a war that the country was not only not especially engaged in, but maybe not even paying attention to. And that has to do with the nature of the force today, which is an all-volunteer outfit. Everyone who comes in today has chosen to be there. There's no conscription. We haven't had conscription since the draft ended in the mid-1970s. And with the absence of conscription, you lose the lottery by which Americans could be called to war. And when you lose the lottery, you lose the shared risk. And so many of the people who join for their own reasons. And those who don't want to join don't even have to consider the possibility that they'll be called to serve. And so we've set up a warrior or a fighter or a service class, even a caste, that is separate from the rest of us. And one of the consequences of that and is a statement like what you saw on the board right there, which was a deep sense of isolation.
So by the time it's all over, and it's not over, but at least up until this point where we're talking, approximately how many Americans have died serving our country in Iraq and Afghanistan?
About 7,000. We've gotten near 7,000 and tens of thousands of more physically wounded. And, of course, hundreds of thousands psychically wounded.
I don't know how it happened, but something in your book caused me to think back to the days when Bush was president, when we were going into Iraq. Gates was the Secretary of Defense. And I was in a used bookstore one day, and I ran across Gates' book that he wrote in 2014, Duty, Memoirs of a Secretary at War. And I'm going to read you a quote, and then I'd like you to comment on it. I believe that at the outset of the Afghan and Iraq wars, neither defense nor VA ever conceived of, much less planned for, the huge number of wounded young men and women, overwhelmingly men, who would come pouring into the system in the years ahead. Many of our troops would not have survived their wounds in previous wars, but extraordinary medical advances and the skills of those treating the wounded meant that a large number would return with complex injuries, including traumatic brain injuries and multiple amputations, facing prolonged treatment, years of rehabilitation, and a lifetime of disability. I read that and I thought, really? The Department of Defense? These guys who tout themselves as the long-range planners of the world, strategic in their thinking and in their operations, and they didn't think about the number of wounded young men and women returning?
So I don't find that statement surprising at all. I mean, you'll find among many of us who served that the gloss is worn off on the DOD mythos. You know, I see the Department of Defense as a huge and not very well-functioning bureaucracy populated by people who are, service members who are endlessly rotating through positions. So just about the time you get really good at a job and master it, you move on to the next duty station. So there's endless turnover. Churn is a feature of this system. Churn means an absence of continuity and difficulties with long-range planning. The political cycle in the country moves so quickly, from congressional election to congressional election, that The attention span of the politicians is not there. Moreover, we have, as a political class, we have ceded a lot of the supervision of the wars through the authorizations of the use for military force, which transfer almost all war-making responsibilities for these particular wars that we're discussing now to the executive branch. And you add all of this together, and I think that it shouldn't be a surprise. It should be almost predictable that the DOD cannot see out a few years or cannot see past the short-term consequences of its actions.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is C.J. Chivers, author of The Fighters, Americans in Combat in Afghanistan and Iraq. What was the scale of waste like from your vantage point, from what you saw? You mentioned that early in the book.
Well, I mean, the waste is immeasurable and takes many forms. And, you know, I can tell little anecdotes. Like, you know, at one point I was going back and forth to the wars for years, and I had this problem with all my equipment. You know, you can imagine the luggage overages and the difficulties of going through some of the Middle Eastern airports with flak jackets and helmets and equipment that looks military as a civilian. And then I decided to ask a major who I knew I'd be returning to his area in a few weeks if I could store my equipment in one of the big Connex boxes and just leave it there and spare myself this and just kind of go home with one backpack. And he said, sure. He gave me a key. I went down to this field full of Connex boxes, and they were numbered or however they were identified. I went and opened mine where I was going to leave my pack for and our equipment for a few weeks, and it was jammed full of flat-screen TVs that had not even been issued out anywhere yet. And I thought, you know, this is what we need to wage these wars. So we need a flat-screen TV in every tent? Or do we have more than one for every tent? Like, what the hell am I looking at? And you would see this across the battlefields, if you can call them that, or across this constellation of outposts that were spread over both countries. All sorts of items that didn't need to be there. All sorts of the bases themselves, in many cases, didn't need to be there. This is sundry waste, you know, in the grand accountancy of things. But you can talk about all of this blood and all of the limbs that were lost and all the lives that were damaged and all the marriages and families that suffered and all of the costs of the long-term care of the veterans who came home, as you just discussed from the excerpt from Secretary Gates' book. And you put this against the service of these people themselves, where they were and why. And the military often was pushing people out into areas on short-term plans where they were supposed to clear an area and help the local government establish itself. And after not very much time, a year, two, three, four, we simply withdrew. And those areas are largely ungoverned today, or at least ungoverned by their governments. They might be under some sort of quasi-government or criminal control by insurgencies or drug dealers or the like. You know, the opium trade dealers and the like. But you look at this, and it's very, very hard to square. It's hard to square emotionally. It's hard to square morally. It's hard to square intellectually. I mean, the waste took many forms, and it is really beyond tallying.
You claim that one of the many sorrows of the wars was the little interaction between Afghan and Iraqi civilians and our military forces. If our mission was to prepare Afghans and Iraqis to take over this fight, it sure sounds like we were missing something. Also in the field, less capable weapons for Iraqi and Afghan soldiers, training insubstantial, medical care inferior. How do you win a war when you're not treating those you want to hand it off to as fairly and equitably as possible?
Well, I mean, the short answer is you don't hand it over very well, and yeah. We didn't. A lot of the Iraqi forces collapsed after we withdrew, and the Afghan forces are having great difficulties holding down areas that are under heavy Taliban influence. And they will continue to have those difficulties because they're not an especially well-equipped or well-trained or well-motivated army. Some of this is a design flaw that we have to own up to. And I mean, I'll give you an example. I don't have the salary figures in front of me right now, but let's say these are going to be ballpark, but they'll be close. But about $200, $250 a month would be what we were paying an Afghan soldier around about 2010. And so $250 a month. Think about it. It's not very much. But you don't really know the economy, so you don't have a context. But let me give you one other element from that economy. The assault rifle that we would give that same soldier, you know, would have to issue to the soldier for the soldier to perform his duties in the field, might sell on the black market for $1,000 or $1,200. So you're sending someone out on an incredibly dangerous job where they know they don't have the same medical care as you. They know they don't have the same equipment as you. They know that they don't largely have a cultural affinity with you. And you're giving them a piece of equipment that's worth 4 or 5 months' pay. It should be no surprise that many of these soldiers sold their rifles and disappeared almost immediately. I mean, it's almost like we through the pay system and the logistics systems, hardwired desertion right into the ranks. As we did this, we tried to make too large a force too quickly without a clear attention to what the problems were that we were hardwiring in on our end. And, you know, from this kind of conceptual failure, it's natural that practical failure would follow, even without an awful war, even without all the enemy actions against these forces on the ground.
Since most of your book is a series of vignettes on these men who are serving on the ground, I want to at least give our listeners a brief snapshot of who they are. Let's talk about Chief Warrant Officer Mike Slobodnik. I guess I have to say who he was and what happened to him.
So before we do that, I'd like to thank you. It's good to shift away from the broad overview that we just talked about down right. to the real substance of the book.
Right.
I mean, I've had to kind of separate the grand march of the war, which has been a failure in the main, from the good faith actions of the people who showed up to try to serve in these wars. And we have to realize that the experiences of the individual and the march of the whole are not entirely distinct, but they are largely separate. And I occupy this unusual place in the conversation where I'm harshly critical of the wars and those who led them, and deeply committed to and empathetic for the people who showed up in good faith to serve in them.
And
one of those, as you mentioned, Mike Slobodnik, is a chief warrant officer in the Army who flew a Kiowa helicopter. It's a two-seater scout helicopter. It's got nothing in the back. You know, it doesn't carry equipment and troops or anything like that. It's a scout reconnaissance helicopter with a machine gun and a rocket pod on it. And Mike flew multiple tours in Iraq and then in Afghanistan. I have different types of characters in the book. That's purposeful. Remember back to the Noah's Ark idea. So Mike was a career soldier. He was in the Persian Gulf War in 1991 and had served in the Army for many years after that continuously, and was, you know, in the parlance of the grunts, he was a lifer. There's also other characters in the books who are those who were compelled to serve immediately after the terrorist attacks in 2001. And they came in a flash of patriotism, and they're a younger generation, and they all worked together. Mike's job was to provide reconnaissance and some close-in gunfire and rocket support for maneuver units on the ground. And there's two chapters of him in the book. One is in Iraq during some of the worst years, and then you'll recall that there was a shift of focus to Afghanistan. Once, you know, during the election in 2008, McCain versus Obama, the national conversation kind of pivoted to, hey, what about Afghanistan? It was in some cases called the good war. And at about that time, Mike's unit was shifted to Afghanistan, and he served his second combat tour there.
I'm Bob Custra, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with C.J. Chivers, author of The Fighters. In the book, Chivers profiles six soldiers in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And again, I want to give our listeners the chance to read your book and not come up with any conclusions until they get to the very end. I'd like to talk as well about another soldier that you cover, Soto, Specialist Robert Soto. And he's looking for a larger purpose in his mission in Afghanistan. And he finally settles on a mantra, we're here because we're here. Could you explain that?
So Rob Soto was the second type of character that I described a moment ago. He was, you know, in elementary school during the attacks on the World Trade Center. He's a New Yorker. He's from the Bronx. And after visiting the rubble soon after the attacks, you know, down at the World Trade Center, he decided that he wanted to ensure his city and his country were never attacked again, and that he would do whatever he could to be part of that assurance. So he enlisted in the Army at age 17, almost immediately upon graduation. And in about a year, he'd gone through all of his training, joined an infantry unit, and been deposited in one of the most difficult spots in Afghanistan at that moment, which is Korangal Valley. Rob showed up, and he was not the first unit in the Korangal Valley. He was fighting a very established, very effective fighting group. It was a mountainous area, sort of the valley's not quite a slot canyon, but you get the idea. It's narrow and steep-sided, it's high elevation, and they were with a limited number of Americans up there. So between having to guard their outposts and go on patrols, they just never had enough to really keep up an op tempo against the insurgency. And they felt often as if they were walking around in someone else's shooting gallery. Later, after he'd been there a while and lost some friends and began to see that maybe there was not a clear purpose that he could understand militarily to what they were doing, he settled on much more personal purposes, which many soldiers and veterans would identify with, which is he was there at that point. After a few months, his squad leader was dead. His mentor, one of the team leaders, was dead. Others had been wounded and killed. He was already exhausted. He was a very young man who had become quite old very quickly, almost instantly. And his purpose for the rest of the tour, and as I said, I think many of your listeners will identify with it, was to give a good account of himself, to be a stand-up soldier, and to take care of the soldiers he was with. It became very narrow, you know, get through this thing, essentially, get through this thing clean.
So tell us about Doc Kirby and the powerful and very tense meeting between this wounded vet, his family, especially his mother, and former President George W. Bush, where the vet's mother confronts the commander who sent her son to war.
So Doc Kirby was a Navy corpsman. A corpsman is a trauma medic in this context who is assigned to a ground Marine Corps unit. So Doc was assigned to an infantry battalion, down to an infantry company, and on his second tour was in a outpost, on the roof of an outpost outside of Fallujah, and was shot through the face by a sniper. He occupies, you know, back to what Gates said, a place in this new population of veterans who would have died in previous wars, but because the medical treatment was so swift and so effective, he survived this incredible injury and came home disfigured, maimed, in incredible pain, dealing with the psychic trauma as well. And he went over the course of several years into a slow and then rapid tailspin that involved painkillers, you know, excessive degrees that made him feel sluggish, and he put on weight, and then he was medically retired from the Navy. He lost his sense of community and came home and put on more weight and took to the booze and was divorced and essentially on a path that looked nowhere good and led finally to a suicide attempt, which he survived. He was then charged criminally for the suicide attempt as it was used a pickup truck, you know, to try to go off the road. So he was charged with reckless driving and on probation. And he was allowed to leave the state of Georgia by his probation officer to go to a event in Texas, a NASCAR event that he was going to be honored at. And at that event, he met a former aide to President Bush, who was then retired, living in Texas. And Doc was invited to see the president with Doc's family the following morning. So like on no notice, you know, he went in like a plaid shirt and a ball cap. And he goes and sees the president, who very graciously sits down with the family without any of his handlers, serves them coffee, talks with them one-on-one in a small room. And they spend a chunk of the morning together. And when it comes Doc's mother's turn to talk with the president, she has prepared a monologue about her suffering and what the family had been through, which the president sat through very cordially. And they had, I don't want to say the last things that were exchanged between them. I'll save that for the readers. But I will say this, the Kirby family left that meeting feeling validated. And whatever your readers think of President Bush, it's not my job to tell them what to think. And I know there's a range of views on that, and so let's just respect that range and say whatever, wherever you are on that scale, the president took the time to allow one of the troops he deployed into combat to come and meet him one-on-one, and he listened to the family's message, which had some real harsh elements. He took it, you know, eye to eye and on the chin, and the result for the family was that for all the horror that they'd been through, they felt validated in a way that they often have not felt validated in larger society. You know, a lot of us tend to walk quickly past the maimed or not to commune with this population of veterans we have now to the extent that we should, because service is no longer shared across the country, is isolated to this volunteer class. There isn't a broad and random understanding of what these wars have been like across our culture. And so many families feel apart from the mainstream of the society. And the president taking this time to meet with the Kirbys meant a lot to them. And the book ends on the particular note and a few things that Doc and the president say to each other. But it was a very meaningful moment for someone who has suffered terribly across all these years.
Well, you've made it pretty clear to our listeners how you feel about the brass at the top of the Pentagon and what it's really dealt our soldiers at the ground level. Any feedback from the Pentagon or any of the officials that might have some responsibility for these wars?
I have not heard from any of the senior leadership. I mean, by senior, I mean, you know, think the generals with multiple stars, the true seniors.
Right.
I don't see a colonel as a senior officer. Some people might, but to me, a colonel is a senior officer the way a bus driver is a senior motorist. You know, the colonel can't get off the route or the schedule. So I've had all sorts of colonels and lieutenant colonels and others I knew across the years contact me and say that the book is, you know, spot on and aligns with their feelings, too. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that I think there's a broad agreement about it. I'm sure there's those who disagree. I accept that. I'm fine with that. But many of the people who reach me may be self-selecting, of course, but I've had a very, very large population of people tell me that the book makes many of these years cohere and puts them into a context that, you know, is available to us now and that might not have been in real time. So I would add this. When I published this book, I expected to be in a public argument. I was fine with that, ready for it. And when I'm in an argument now, I'm energized by it. I don't have any problem with arguing about this stuff. I feel what I feel. And I feel it for reasons that are true to my assessment of these wars and my firsthand observations of them across time. And then I have to add, so I showed up expecting a fight, a big public argument. And I have to add that I misread this moment in time. I have had almost no argument or dispute whatsoever about this. I think that it's generally understood. It's been now at this point baked into our consciousness that somehow these wars did not succeed. Mm-hmm. That, you know, in the main, they did not achieve what they set out to do on the Pentagon's own terms. And I think that that's largely inarguable in the society right now. People can argue about whether or not we should say this because, you know, is it somehow disrespectful to be honest? I get the emotional argument. But on the facts, there has been no pushback on any of this.
Well, that's why I wanted to bring you on Reader's Corner, because I think the book has such a great message. And in a sense, what you're saying as to how we got into all these wars is all goes back to that saying on the wall, Americans were at the mall, and maybe your book will help Americans understand they have to pay a little closer attention to what's going on outside of the domestic economy and start holding public officials accountable for their actions, which we didn't do very well in these two wars. C.J. Chivers, we're out of time. I really appreciate the time you've given us with this interview. Thank you so much for being with us today at Reader's Corner.
Been a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Custra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that shape our world here at Reader's Corner.